Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this entire hour is Frank Langfitt. Langfitt spent nearly two decades as an international correspondent reporting for more than 50 countries and territories.
For more, we turn to NPR's London correspondent, Frank Langfitt, in Belfast.
For more, we turn to NPR's Frank Langfitt, who is following the story from London.
NPR's Frank Langfitt reports from Sarajevo.
In the city of Shanghai, China.
In the French resort of Biarritz.
In Glasgow.
In Madrid.
It's from Ukraine's Donbass region.
From the Welsh town of Barry.
These days, Langfitt covers threats to democracy at home and abroad as NPR's global democracy correspondent. Most recently, he was based in London. He covered the UK and Ireland, as well as the war in Ukraine and its implications in Europe. Before Europe, he spent 5 years as NPR correspondent in China, where he covered the first term of Chinese President Xi Jinping. Before moving to Shanghai, Langfitt was NPR's East Africa correspondent. There he was based in Nairobi. In 2022, Langfitt won an Edward R. Murrow Award for a journey across London exploring the evolution of the English pub. You have a chance to meet Langfitt, Frank Langfitt, in person. He's coming to Iowa April 10th to speak at the Old Capitol Museum in Iowa City. In a video and audio presentation, he'll recount the history he's witnessed through the people he's met, how that history has shaped today's challenging geopolitical landscape. It's a talk presented by the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council. IPR is one of the co-sponsors. For information about attending in person, go to ipr.org/events. The deadline to register is April 3rd. Frank Langfitt joins me from Washington. Frank, welcome to the program. So great to have you on.
Hey, Ben, it's great to be here. And it was fascinating to hear all those places I was reporting. It sort of brought back a lot of my career.
If you'd like to join us this hour, we have Frank on live, 1-866-780-9100. If you've dreamt of being a foreign correspondent, perhaps you have a question for Frank. 1-866-780-9100 or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. So let's talk about this position because it's not something that NPR listeners have heard very much. Perhaps it's a new position. Global democracy correspondent.
It is a new position, and one of the things that NPR has been trying to do in recent years is focus, of course, on the big themes. There's so much to cover in domestic news and international news. I mean, ever since 2016, I think a lot of us in the news business, and I'm sure certainly a lot of the audience out there has been, you know, worn out by all that's happened. But I was interested in doing this because of the work that I'd done in China, and living under authoritarian regime, and also seeing this, you know, democracy in retreat in a variety of places, and certainly then covering the war in Ukraine. You know, I was there for the opening of the invasion and a number of times afterwards. And that, to me, was also a democracy story. Here's a sovereign nation, the first time really since, you know, World War II, that a big country in Europe had attacked a sovereign nation and a democracy, and it was an authoritarian country attacking democracy. So all these sorts of things, I thought, you know, this is a place that I should sort of look at and put a lot of energy into because it's so important and the stakes are so high for the United States, but also much of the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. You've reported on how this year, 2024, will be a key test for the health of democracy around the world. Let's talk about that, which is at the center of your position at NPR. Democracy around the world has been in decline. What would you say are the forces driving that decline?
Well, I mean, one thing is, you know, democracy in various countries, people don't feel that it's been working, and this is true in the United States as well. You've seen, let's take a place like the Philippines, if you go quite a few years back, terrible crime problem, Rodrigo Duterte takes over. And of course, in the end, ends up, you know, overseeing a lot of killings, thousands and thousands of people, extrajudicial killings, but still remains very popular because people were looking for a strong man. You see that with Bukele in El Salvador as well, who just had to, most recently in the last few months, was able to win another term, in part by changing the constitution. You've seen Viktor Orban doing this in Hungary. And certainly you have these tensions in the United States. So one thing is people not feeling that democracy is working for them. I think income inequality is a big part of it as well. You know, people would look at the United States and other countries where they don't feel that they have the opportunity to really move up, that the system, you know, in terms of legislation and tax code, things like that, really favors people who already have a lot of capital. And that's really a source of frustration. And then what you've seen, Ben, that's really interesting is that the kind of approach to authoritarianism is really not the old Mao school or Stalin school, where you end up trying to, frankly, kill a lot of your opponents. It's much more subtle. They do this with the courts. They try to defang the courts. I was just in Israel back in December and talking to a lot of people about the attempts there by the government to, from their perspective, make sure the courts really weren't a check and balance on the system. So it's much more subtle in the case of Orban, Viktor Orban in Hungary, kind of essentially taking over the media. So it's sort of much more strategic and not so obvious necessarily. But there's a whole authoritarian playbook, and people have been using it at least for the last decade or 15 years.
Yeah, right. Talk a little bit more about that playbook, because you mentioned the courts. That's certainly one target for would-be authoritarians. What else is in that playbook?
Well, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, even at the micro and the macro level, so like at the micro level, in a place like China, obviously there are no free elections there. But for dissidents, I mean, sometimes they will be disappeared. Sometimes they'll be, arrested. But what they also do, and I saw this for many years in China, is they just put pressure on people's parents. You know, people's parents lose their job. If you're a dissident and you're talking out too much and the party's unhappy with you, maybe your dad loses his job. Maybe your brother loses his apartment. There are all kinds of ways behind the scenes to do these sorts of things, put pressure on and not leave obvious marks and create some kind of plausible deniability. I mean, that's certainly one of the playbooks that we see. Also, you know, there's always talk about free and fair elections. Well, you know, sometimes it might be a free election, everybody gets to vote, but it's not fair because they find legalistic reasons to keep people who are potential challengers to the authoritarian in charge, keep them off the ballot. That happens frequently. And so it's also not an easy thing to report about sometimes because it's not sensational. It's not open conflict. But this is being used everywhere. And you see a lot of the same regimes resorting to the same kind of tactics. And there's no sign that there's some grand conspiracy that all the authoritarians get together and trade tactics. But they watch each other. Obviously, through the internet, everybody has access to this information and can see what's going on. And it is a challenge. And some of them are very clever, I will say, a lot of authoritarian leaders. And the last thing I'll add is just repression of the internet. I mean, I lived for 5 years under the Great Firewall of China, where you couldn't get access to tons and tons of sites. And China has been exporting that some of that very software to other countries who see what China's done and are, you know, authoritarians like the tactics that they see, and China's happy to sell the software and also help let them know ways that they can use this to their advantage.
Yeah. Attacking the courts, also attacking the media here in the U.S. We have a long tradition of political candidates, office holders, in to some degree, Frank, attacking the media, if you want to put it that harshly. But that has really been upped in recent years. How do we know the line between criticizing media coverage and attacking the media as a would-be authoritarian would?
Well, I mean, you know, if you want to criticize coverage, you should be focusing on whether it's factually accurate or not. And often what we've seen in over the years here and elsewhere is that the attacks don't have to do with the facts at all. In fact, it's actually factually accurate. It more tends to be character assassination. I mean, the whole statement that we got from Donald Trump many years ago, the enemies of the people, I mean, that's a classic kind of authoritarian phrasing, which doesn't really address the coverage itself, but simply to say these people are your enemies. That kind of personalization, I've been at this like you, Ben. I've been working as a journalist for a long time. Until 2016, we didn't see anything like that. And that was more reminiscent of things that I would have seen sometimes working in a place like China, the way the Communist Party talked to us as foreign reporters, particularly American reporters, as saying we weren't friendly, we were very oppositional from their perspective. But even they didn't go that far. Honestly, that's what's interesting, is an authoritarian country like China, the leaders there didn't go as far. And then once you saw it happen in the United States, you saw it echoed in places like Hungary, in places like China, and certainly, obviously, in Vladimir Putin's Russia.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple minutes before we take a break, Frank. But broadly speaking, what's at stake in 2024? Of course, in any election, we have policies and we have big ticket items on the that we know from polls are on voters' minds, abortion, inflation, immigration. But where does democracy and the threat to democracy in our country fit into that?
Well, I think, you know, Biden's running on that. He's been very explicit. I've been very interested to see, given my experience overseas, to see that the President of the United States is making this a centerpiece of his run. I think there's sort of two elements to it. One is, if Donald Trump does not win, does he accept it, which he didn't accept it back in 2020 in terms of a verdict, and what happens there? And the other thing is, if he does win, and, you know, if he wins, he wins. That's the way the system works here. But he's already made it very clear in terms of what he'd like to do to the civil service here in Washington, D.C., in the federal civil service, that he wants to replace a lot of people with loyalists. So he's kind of running on a platform that talks about eroding some of the checks and balances that have been a hallmark of American democracy. So he's been pretty explicit, and he says even, you know, I'll be a dictator on day one or just for day one, exactly how he phrases it. But that's an extraordinary thing for someone to say who's running for president. So I think the stakes are extremely high, and I think it's also, having worked so much time overseas, particularly in Europe, I can tell you that people all over the world are watching this election very, very closely, and I think that they will see it as to some degree determinative of the future course of this country.
My guest this hour, Frank Langfitt, joining us, NPR's global democracy correspondent. And when we come back, I want to pick up on that point you just mentioned, Frank. How our global friends and our adversaries around the world view our political dysfunction, the threats, the opportunities, they say. You can join our conversation with Frank Langfitt. What's your question for Frank? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Back in just a moment with Frank Langfitt.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the Extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back with more of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour, Frank Langfitt. He spent nearly two decades as an international correspondent, reporting for more than 50 countries and territories, last based in London, covering the UK, Ireland, but also one of just a few correspondents from NPR covering the outbreak of the war in Ukraine and its implications in Europe. Spent 5 years as a correspondent in China, also in East Africa before that, based in Nairobi. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Here's a question, Frank, from Gary in Davenport. He wonders, in places where you do not know the language, how do you get to the truth?
That's a great question. One of the things, in the places where I don't know the language, we work with translators. In some cases, when, for instance, in Israel, Daniel Estrin has been there for 15 plus years, and Daniel speaks Hebrew and Arabic both fluently, but he, when we were covering, I guess, the first few weeks, and certainly when I was there in December, covering the war in Gaza, he had a great group of translators that we worked with, who he'd been working with off and on, we'd known, NPR had known for many years, and we rely a great deal on them, and we also just do all that we can possibly do to confirm facts with official sources, the government and elsewhere. So that's one way we do it. In Ukraine, when we were covering the beginning of the war, we worked closely with translators as well. And we traveled with them, and often as a group, like when you're going out and you're actually covering the conflict, you're traveling with a security officer, a driver who's Ukrainian, and then a translator. And that's primarily how we do it. That's the way it works.
Mm-hmm. Frank, let's go to the question of how the world is viewing our political dysfunction here in recent years, how our friends are seeing it, how our adversaries. Let's start with our adversaries. You were lived and worked in China for many years. Perhaps we can start there, how they are viewing us at this time.
Well, I think to the degree that the United States looks inward and that the United States has domestic political conflict, that's advantageous to China. In fact, pretty much any time the United States is distracted from China, by and large, that's good for Xi Jinping and the Communist Party. And I'll give you some examples. I mean, when the United States went to war in Afghanistan and then also into Iraq, that gave, you know, that really, the United States couldn't focus on China, and that gave China a lot of opportunity to do the kinds of things it wanted to in terms of the Belt and Road Initiative of building these trade routes out towards the West. And so that's seen as very advantageous. You know, in terms of Russia, for instance, obviously they've been very involved. They were involved in the 2016 election, and they like to see a distracted America as well, because when the United States is looking inside, or when it's distracted with other issues overseas, that just gives them a lot more room to maneuver. So generally speaking, I think they welcome that. The Chinese are more interested in stability than the Russians. The Russians' approach tends to be sowing chaos and confusion works pretty well for them. They're a middle power. But China's a very big, big power, and it also does rely on the United States in certain respects, particularly the U.S. Navy, to continue to provide security for shipping. And of course, China ships a tremendous amount of products. It's a big trading nation. So it's a little more, it doesn't want the United States descending into chaos at all, because it has benefited from the system that the United States has overseen pretty much since World War II. But generally speaking, when the Americans are at each other's throats on Capitol Hill, that's beneficial to our adversaries, no doubt.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've had this inward look, this political dysfunction, mm-hmm. and the war in Ukraine, and that has prevented what has been talked about for a long time, which is the pivot to Asia, which China does not want, right?
Yeah. I mean, China hates that, and understandably so. So people were talking about the pivot to Asia back in the Obama administration, whether it was the first or second term. And I had been reporting from China actually since the 1990s. I had done a stint earlier with the Baltimore Sun from 97 to 2002. And it was pretty clear to us, Ben, as reporters, that this was going to be the global story. The country was growing at 10, 12, 14% at times. It was staggering. This has never happened in human history. And we were on the ground mm-hmm. seeing this, and you know, we would talk sometimes to people in the State Department. We'd say, you know, this is really a big deal, and they knew that. But it was hard for the United States because the landscape, the global landscape was so uncertain, and you had 9/11, then you had the war in Iraq, and then, of course, you had the global financial crisis. There were a variety of distractions, plus things also going on in the Middle East. Now, it's not to say these things aren't very important, but when you think about what's the biggest geopolitical rival to the U.S., there's no question, it's China. And so what happens is the United States continues to try to pivot Asia. What I mean by that is really strengthen these alliances, and from China's perspective, contain China. But it's hard to do because things keep happening. And Gaza is a great example. I mean, up until, you know, in the days before, the weeks before Gaza, people had talked about, I think Jake Sullivan had talked about how quiet the Middle East had been. And of course, now not only has this consumed American policy, you know, not only has it consumed America in terms of foreign policy, but it's also redrawn some of the dynamics in the Democratic Party. And it's a challenge domestically, obviously, for President Biden as he runs for a second term. So there's they were actually doing quite well on the pivot. They've really strengthened their relationships with Japan and with Korea and with Australia. They're doing a big sub deal with Australia, 12 subs, which could be a bit of a game changer, frankly, in the South China Sea. But it's always been a challenge for the Americans to keep focused because there are so many places that are so unpredictable around the world.
Frank Langfitt is NPR's global democracy correspondent. We have the pleasure of spending the hour with Frank. 1-866-780-9100 or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. A question for you from Matthew, who is listening. Frank, what have you seen in work in other countries that have defeated populist authoritarian figures?
That's a very good question, Matthew. I mean, one thing, let's take Poland, for example. Poland had really shifted far to the right, and they had also, the government there had really damaged the judiciary. But that government was very corrupt, and it was also not very competent. And in the end, they lost out, and people were able to run against them on corruption. And there was enough freedom in terms of freedom of expression and freedom of the press to be able to do that. So what you've seen in some countries is when some of these authoritarian regimes are not yet strong enough to completely neuter, you know, a free press, people who are, you know, really defending democracy and want to run against them develop very good strategies, political and electoral strategies to go after their weaknesses. That would be one example. Another example, and I do want to, you know, as we talk about democracy in decline, I also want to point out there's a lot of ebb and flow here because we're talking about individual countries. I mean, Guatemala is a great example where the system, the establishment did everything to prevent the freely elected new leader of Guatemala to take office. And in the end, the United States put some pressure on it. It wasn't just the U.S., but there was a lot of civil society that gets very involved. And they were able to put enough pressure on to so that he, it's one of the really very positive stories out of Latin America in the last 12 months, he was able to take over. And I'll give you just one other example from my experience reporting in Israel, which I found really, really informative. You know, everybody here would remember, you know, many, many months ago when there was an attempt to change the judiciary in Israel through what was called reform, but was widely seen as an attempt to take over the judiciary by the government or basically prevent it from being a check on government power. Hundreds of thousands of people came out in the streets. Now, people that I know who worked on this topic in Israel were shocked. They thought this was so esoteric that people wouldn't pay attention. But in fact, that's not what happened at all. And they put a lot of pressure on the government. And then what I found was interesting is after the war broke out in Gaza, after the attacks of October 7th, there were a group of people, these are reservists, who had been very involved in defending the judiciary. And they became more and more politically involved. They went down to Gaza, to the Gaza border, to help evacuate people and fill the gap that in the vacuum that the government had failed to do, you know, after the attacks. And they got more and more involved. And I interviewed them a lot. And then I said to them at one point, when I was talking to them in December, I said, are you guys going to run for office? Because they seemed so energized by this. And they said, yeah, we probably will. And sure enough, just about a month ago, there's a group called Brothers and Sisters in Arms. They started their own political party. And so the next time there is an election in Israel, these people who had not been very politically involved are going to run against Netanyahu and the leading, you know, the ruling coalition. And that was all because of attacks on the judiciary. So civil society can do a lot, especially in a democracy, which Israel is still a democracy.
Yeah, with those examples in mind, Frank, fascinating. We have to then sort of pivot the spotlight back to us here in the U.S. It begs the question, what might a more authoritarian system in the U.S. look like? What would reaction to that be? We have scenarios, you know, the November election looming out there. We could have any number of outcomes, Biden winning convincingly, Biden winning by a hair, Trump winning convincingly or by a hair.
Yeah, it's hard to know. I mean, this is an incredibly unpredictable election. It's very, very close in a number of places. We still have, I mean, we just learned that on April 15th, unless there's some other delay, President Trump will go on trial in New York. That's unprecedented. And you don't know, A, how the trial will turn out, and then how people will respond to whatever the verdict is and what that does in terms of his support. You also see that Nikki Haley, while she's no longer in the race, President Trump has not reached out to her supporters. And it's, I mean, I don't cover American politics. I just watch it like everybody else. But I think it's very unpredictable. One of the challenges will be that if President Trump does win and he does come back into office, he will not have some of the guardrails that he had in more traditional people in the cabinet. He's not interested in those sorts of people in key cabinet positions. And so there will be fewer people to try to restrain some of his proclivities. And then I think that does, you end up with a civil society question, is how does civil society react to that if the system itself is not able to stop things that the population is very unhappy with in terms of eroding checks and balances? Then I think you see what civil society does. The answer in Israel was enormous protests. So we'll see what happens between now and early November.
Yeah. Could something like January 6th happen again?
You know, we have reporters who cover that. And that's not something that I focus on specifically. I will say that January 6th occurred in part because it was a bit of a surprise, even if people in Washington knew they had things to be worried about. When you lose the element of surprise, and that's a big deal. I mean, first of all, Trump could win, in which there will be no sort of storming of the Capitol. But I think that when you lose the element of surprise, that's very important. It's not as though law enforcement in this country, in this city, is not going to be aware of what potentially could happen. And I'm sure they will have had 4 years to prepare for anything that might come their way. And I have to think that that puts them in a much better position than they were January 6th, after the election of 2020, when clearly they were not prepared for what was coming up Capitol Hill.
Mm-hmm. You talked about how our adversaries see our political dysfunction. We didn't get to the friends part. What about the EU, Britain, Japan, Australia, New Zealand? How are they viewing us as Western
stunned
democracies?
They're stunned. I mean, I was in 2016, I was in the U.S. Embassy in London watching the returns, and people in the United Kingdom were very surprised that Americans chose somebody like Donald Trump, who also did not have this sense of a transatlantic alliance or even as much interested in alliances. You know, he's a very transactional, real estate person. And when you look at NATO, I spent a lot of time covering NATO. You know, people in Europe, they depend on the United States for security, and they also feel, whatever the differences there are between the French and the Americans and the Germans and the Americans, there are shared values and shared beliefs and shared democratic beliefs. And so in Donald Trump coming in, he was not interested in those kinds of alliances, and he's been very critical, and there's concern that he might try to pull out of NATO, or if he can't actually pull out of it, he could kind of not participate. America not participating, which would really hurt NATO. So I would say that they are watching each election, trying to figure out if the United States is the country they thought it was before 2016. And they're concerned. And I think that this is also, that's another reason why I think this election is so important, because if Donald Trump wins, many of our traditional allies, particularly in Europe, will really be concerned. And they will think, well, maybe America is not a place that we can rely on at all. And that sort of changes everything. Now, we can talk a little bit when we get into about kind of what's the responsibility of countries in Europe to defend themselves. Certainly with Ukraine, right, that has really, the invasion of Ukraine has really pushed that question to the fore.
Right. We have a couple minutes, so let's talk about that, because it has lit a fire under the EU, so to speak, to come up with more monies. And also, this is, a byproduct of Donald Trump saying, they've got to pay more for their own defense, right? And they are doing just that.
And I want to say that Trump saying they need to spend more money on their own defense is the same thing that Obama said and other presidents have said, and Trump is right. I think it's very important to say that that general message is absolutely true. The United States spends, I believe it's like, if you look at all of the spending, 70 cents on the dollar comes from the United States in terms of, you know, all of the spending of the NATO allies. And so Trump is right about that. The other thing is that for Europe and for NATO, they're going to have to spend a lot more on their own defense, because the United States really is going to continue to be focused on China. And NATO, there's no blue water navy in NATO that can get to Asia and really support the U.S. So I think as the U.S. continues to focus on Asia, the powers there in Europe are going to have to do a lot more to defend Ukraine and defend the Eastern Front against Russia. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just an inevitability. The question is, how do they do it and how quickly do they do it? Because most of them are not remotely at the capacity to be able to provide the way that the Americans did. And without the American support, while the EU did a good job, very good job, at the early days of the war in Ukraine, without the Americans, the Russians would have probably rolled across Ukraine, almost certainly. And it was the American weaponry and the American support that made a huge difference in keeping the Russians out of Kyiv and keeping the Russians from sweeping the country.
Back with a final segment, Frank Langfitt joins us live, NPR's global democracy correspondent, covers threats to democracy at home and abroad. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. When we come back, I want to ask Frank a little bit more about working in Ukraine, covering that as the war broke out there, and the keys to getting the stories out of a war zone. When we return, it's River to River from IPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back with more River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Frank Langfitt of NPR is my guest this hour, NPR's global democracy correspondent. He has a great history of spending nearly two decades as an international correspondent, reporting for more than 50 countries and territories, based in London, covering the war in Ukraine, also based for many years in China, and before that in Africa. Let's talk, Frank, a little bit about your work in Ukraine. You were one of three NPR correspondents, I understand, in Ukraine when Russia invaded in February of 2022. I want to have us listen to a little bit of your coverage. I think this dates from about a year ago, March of 2023.
There's about 15 border force soldiers basically lying on the ground, this snow-covered field, and they're learning how to cock and fire their weapons, fortunately with no bullets in them at the moment.
Okay, Frank, tell us about that experience. When the war broke out, where were you?
So I was in Odessa. I used to be an economics and business correspondent, so I thought it would be important to be down along the Black Sea, because I knew that if the Russia's Black Sea fleet could seal that off, it would really strangle the economy. And so what happened was, I guess about midnight or so, I was in touch with Tom Bowman, who's our Pentagon correspondent. He's an old friend. We've known each other for a number of decades. And he told me that there would be an invasion the next morning, you know, within, you know, before dawn, and that I should be, you know, prepared for that. And at that time, if you remember, the Pentagon thought that this was something that could, that Kyiv could fall within 48, 72 hours. And so the advice that I was getting was basically get out of there. Get out of Odessa, maybe even get out of Ukraine. And then that morning at about a little after 5 o'clock, we heard the missiles hitting in Odessa. And we were concerned about an air assault, so I went to my driver and my translators I was explaining earlier, and I couldn't convince them that this invasion was actually happening. And that was because President Zelensky had convinced many, many Ukrainians that this was never going to happen at all, and they believed him. And so we were driving just to get out of Odessa because we were concerned that if there were an air assault in Odessa, we would get pinned in. And I was with my translator at the time, and she was looking at at her phone and saying, there's no invasion. I don't see anything on Twitter. And I said, you know, this is how reporting works. We actually, we find out what happens and then we report on it. And we were able to make our way north. And then over a series of days, we must have driven at least 1,500 miles across the country and watching the whole country change, Ben, every 24 hours as people came to realize that this was an existential threat. And so you'd be driving along perfectly normal, like any place in Iowa or here. And then the next morning, you would see people putting up sandbags and creating checkpoints. And then old farmers coming out to, you know, a cultural center in a small village to sign up to fight at the front and get their machine guns and head off to fight the Russians. So it was remarkable to see a country change so rapidly from this sense that this is never going to happen to, oh my gosh, the Russians want to take over our country.
Yeah. And also the mood there, you're seeing it change. And uniformly against the Russians, or were they elements that were not so against this intervention?
Yeah, that's a great question. In Kyiv and to the west for sure, very European leaning and very focused on Europe. In parts of the Donbass and also parts of the south, which is where I spent a lot of time, and I spent a lot of time down in both areas. You will go into places. This was really interesting and kind of creepy, is that there was a lot of support for Russia, and partly for cultural reasons, partly because they had watched a lot of Russian TV and they believed what they were hearing, but they felt more of an affinity to Russia. And so what would happen is during these big battles for these towns and cities, most people would leave, but some of the people who would be left would be very pro-Russian. So we would have reporters go into small villages and it would be pretty bombed out. And then they might see a few men like, oh, who are these guys? And they would go into the village and within 10 minutes, there would be Russian artillery. So these were Ukrainian men who were actually working as spotters for the Russians. And they would call in airstrikes to hit the journalists. And I was working. I did one story that was really interesting where I spent time with a young Polish man who was driving into Bakhmut, which at the time was the most devastated city in terms of artillery. And he would rescue people, old people, from the few that were left there. And he brought out one couple that I met, and they were fascinating because they looked like characters out of Dr. Zhivago. They had these big fur hats, and they were very sophisticated doctors. And then when you talk to them, they would say, oh, Russia has nothing to do with this. This is really, it's not Russia's fault. And I was like, what? And that's because the people who were staying on were still very pro-Russian, even as Russia was decimating their towns. And it was interesting to talk to this Polish guy who was liberal and very, obviously very Western-oriented, that he was rescuing people who were supportive of the Russians who had done this big invasion. So as you go pretty far east, it gets a lot more complicated and frankly, a lot more interesting.
Yeah, that affinity toward Russia to the degree that it existed at the outbreak of war. What has happened to that affinity in the past 2 years? Has that been diminished?
Well, it has. I mean, in most of the country is not in favor of Russia, and they didn't like Russia to begin with. So before the war happened, I was spending time in Kyiv in the Maidan. This is the Independent Square, and I was there for a memorial. More than 100 people were killed in 2014 who were protesting a pro-Russian regime and ended up actually toppling that regime in the end. And certainly people in the Maidan, they didn't like Russia at all. They really had a much greater affinity with the West. But still to this day, I mean, an interesting question is, even if Ukraine were able to take back a lot of this territory, what would happen if you take back territory where the people who are left there are actually quite pro-Russian? I mean, that's complicated. Generally speaking, the country is extremely anti-Putin and was back then, and now they're far more embittered because everybody now has suffered loss. You know, as the war grinds on every month, you know, more and more people have either lost someone very close to them or been injured themselves, certainly many soldiers that I worked with a year ago. One of them was a sniper named Max, and he was an excellent warrior, basically, and he lost his foot to a landmine. You know, when the Russians were laying all these landmines to prevent a counteroffensive, Max was in a hospital, and Max can't go back and fight because he's lost his foot. So there's a lot of that has happened.
Final 10 minutes with Frank Langfitt, NPR's global democracy correspondent. Maddie in Davenport has a question for you, Frank, that has to deal with working in Ukraine and other such war zones. When working with people with trauma, Maddie asks, like those in a war zone, how do you handle such sensitive topics? How do you deal with people who are traumatized, I guess, is a good question.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'll give you an example of this. I mean, it's hard because as a reporter, I want to ask a lot of questions of people and have them be able to tell our listeners what it's like to go through this and what it means at the human level. At the same time, you know, you can end up just making their lives more difficult. And I just try to read it as best I can. Sometimes I don't ask the questions that I would ask if it were a normal interview in a normal place. And I'll give you an example. I was walking through Ramallah, sort of the capital of the West Bank, the, you know, basic capital of the West Bank, back in December. And I was doing an economic story, Ben. So I was just chatting with people, stopping in shops. Mm-hmm. And I met a man on a corner, and he told me that he used to work in Israel. And, of course, he could not go across the border because the Israelis had blocked it. And this is very important to the economy of the West Bank. But he also told me that he was originally from Gaza and his family was in Gaza. And we're just chatting about economics. And then he sort of said, oh, and by the way, 7 of the 8 members of my family were killed about 10 days ago in Israeli drone strikes in Gaza City. And he said, one of my sons is still under the rubble. And my other son who was there buried the rest of the family. And I've covered some conflict. There are people who are real raw reporters here at NPR. I'm not. I cover these stories as they come. But I couldn't remember ever speaking to somebody who had lost so much, and it literally, you know, within a minute, he'd lost practically everything that mattered to him. And I didn't have another question to ask because I also didn't want to ask. I asked a few detailed questions, but I just thought, I'm going to be respectful of this guy. He suffered so much. I didn't feel comfortable. And it didn't detract from the story, because simply the facts, as he told them, were very compelling. And I did put him in a story, of course. But I just restrained myself because I just thought, you know, he can tell the story perfectly fine and you don't need to probe, because it's more important to let him tell a little bit of his story and just to show some humanity towards somebody who has suffered something that is, to all of us, I'm sure, listening, pretty much unimaginable.
Yeah. Frank, what in particular are you watching in the EU parliamentary elections this year? We talked about the pro-Russian sentiment in some parts, Donbass, for instance, in Ukraine. But how much support do you think there is for Putin and his aims within the EU?
Well, I think in terms of the parliamentary elections, which will be in June, I think that more populist and right-wing parties are expected to do considerably better, and that will put more pressure on aid for Ukraine. And there's been a lot of back and forth over the years. The first big story I covered in Europe, I arrived a week before the Brexit vote, so I got a good look at some of those sentiments in England and in the United Kingdom, and what a big impact that they can have politically. Things ebb and flow in Europe. I mean, I covered a man named Geert Wilders, who I covered his election. He ran in 2017, very right wing in the Netherlands, did not win. And now, most recently, in the last year or so, he was able to come back and do very, very well. And actually, his party got the most votes. So I think it's just worth watching that very closely, as well, you know, as other parts of the world, as populists gain ground. Of course, populism in Europe is also very complicated, and you can have a populist who also is willing to work with the rest of Europe to defend that eastern flank. But I think the parliamentary elections, it's not something Americans pay that much attention to, but given the fluidity of global politics these days, it's worth keeping an eye on all these places.
Mm-hmm. Comment on NATO's expansion, now including Sweden and Finland, and that vast border now with Russia that NATO has.
Yeah, I mean, that's great for NATO. First of all, those are two actually very effective militaries. And by getting Sweden and Finland coming in, it basically turns the Baltic Sea into a NATO lake. So that for the Russians to try to operate in any aggressive way in the Baltic Sea seems extremely difficult. I mean, they would be surrounded by NATO countries. And also, Sweden has a very, very strong presence in the Baltic. So that's actually, that's a big addition. You know, sometimes countries come into NATO, some of these smaller Eastern European countries, and they don't really tip the balance at all. They don't, you know, it doesn't do very much. But Sweden and Finland are a very big change and very bad news for Vladimir Putin. It's interesting. I covered in 2018, NATO military exercises in fjords up in Norway. And so that was an area that NATO at the time was thinking was very vulnerable. But now I would think with what's happening in Finland and Sweden, it's far that part of Scandinavia is far less vulnerable because they're in the NATO fold.
It's been asked many times in many ways and answered in many different ways. The mindset of Vladimir Putin after this can only be described, I guess, as this massive miscalculation going into Ukraine, invading Ukraine. With your insights and having reported from China, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the mindset of a leader, an authoritarian leader, the longer they are in power.
Well, I mean, everybody gets invested. You know, you come into power, and this would be true also in city politics in the United States. You come into power, you have people who support you, and then the longer you're in power, the people who support you benefit a great deal. What's different is when you have a kind of a kleptocracy in Russia, it means that a lot of people want to support you because if something changes, it really dramatically changes their lives, and they can become vulnerable to prosecution. And so that's one of the reasons I think that somebody like Putin continues to enjoy support, because his main constituencies and some of the oligarchs have been very supportive of him. And those who have not, he's shown a willingness to really go after them. And when you look at Xi Jinping in China, you know, it's very interesting. When I was there in 2012, 2013, after he'd just taken office, he had this massive anti-corruption campaign that was incredibly popular. I mean, in some ways, I was supportive of it because the stealing in China at that time by officials was staggering. I was really shocked by it. But what he also did, he put 1 million people in jail, and a lot of them were people who were his opponents. And so for someone like Xi Jinping, who now has no term limits, they changed the constitution. I mean, one thing would be, how would he ever leave office? Because he has so many enemies and he has family members and vulnerabilities. How would he ever move on and not be afraid for what would happen to people because he has so enemies? So you also, I mean, I'm not being sympathetic towards these folks, but you can see also they want to stay in power for all kinds of reasons, including because the repercussions of what would happen if they left power.
Mm-hmm. In the final 30 seconds or so, Frank, as the NPR Global Democracy Correspondent, is there anything we've left off? We've talked about so much this hour that you have your eyes on for the rest of 2024. Quickly.
No, I'm just interested in seeing how the rest of the elections run this year. There are more people able to go to the polls in the world than ever before, and I'm going to be fascinated to see by the time we get to New Year's Eve exactly how democracy has fared and where there have been wins and where there have been losses and we've seen decline, and if we know a lot more about the trajectory of democracy around the world.
Okay, thank you very much for joining us live this hour, Frank Langfitt, NPR's Global Democracy Correspondent. Frank, we look forward to seeing you here in Iowa next month.
I look forward to it, too. It's going to be great fun.
Go to ipr.org/events to find out how you can attend an event coming up on April 10th with Frank Langfitt. Today's program produced by Caitlin Troutman with help from Samantha McIntosh. Tomorrow, it's a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. Political scientist Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College will be with us. Also, analysis from journalism scholar Kelly Winfrey of Iowa State University. We'll talk about what's going on with the U.S. Supreme Court considering the abortion drugs and also the aftermath of that Moscow concert hall attack and Gaza and so much more.